It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, we continue our summer music series set list. Today we'll feature the Oshkosh rock band, The Traveling Suitcase.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of the state's biggest stories in our Wisconsin News Roundup.
The state assembly approved a deal for a new Milwaukee Bucks arena. We'll get the latest on the proposal and discuss what happens next. And Wisconsin's open records law was another big topic this week.
We're joined now by Don Hubscher, editor for the Eau Claire Leader Telegram, to talk more about these stories. Don, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, the Bucks deal was a big story. The assembly passed a bill funding a new Milwaukee arena with a $250 million price tag. How did that deal get done?
Well, you know, you don't hear much about bipartisanship anymore, but it really did happen that way, at least in our area, and I thought it was pretty interesting. I can't remember the last time there was a vote like this, but in our area, there's eight legislators, assembly people, and three Republicans voted for it, three Republicans voted against it, one Democrat, Dana Locks, voted for it, one Democrat, Chris Danow from Temple, voted against it. And I couldn't help but think, as I was listening to the newscast about national transportation funding, if we could just have something like that with our state transportation problems, we'd really be on to something. But I think up here anyway, one of the things that Representative Locks talked about is we have something similar here at a much smaller scale. They're trying to build an arts center up here in cooperation with local government, private interests, and UW-Eau Claire, and it would replace the UW-Eau Claire Theater and our community theater. And just the talk of that has really brought in private interest, and there's been kind of a renaissance in downtown Eau Claire, and I think Representative Locks was talking about what that could be for Milwaukee. And so I think in the end, more Republicans and Democrats felt like, you know, there is a role for government to play in economic development.
Will there be a difference between how Milwaukee County residents and taxpayers from the state contribute to the arena?
Well, yeah, that was one of the things that Governor Walker and the legislature tried to sell, is that the state contribution is capped at $4 million a year for 20 years, whereas city and county of Milwaukee are going to have to contribute a lot more than that, and I'm not sure how that's going to play down there, probably not as well, but I suppose folks who remember Miller Park and that whole fight, you know, look back now and think, well, we're glad that we were able to keep the Brewers.
Now, the Bucks Arena deal has been contentious in Milwaukee. You have a sense how residents in your neck of the woods, western Wisconsin, have felt about it?
Well, you know, I think there is some sentiment, of course, that, you know, we have a public university here, and they took the $250 million hit. And I think there are still some people that feel that, you know, we have to cut back significantly on our public university system, yet they were able to find this pool of money. But as the advocates say, well, if you look at the income taxes that the players bring in, the benefits of keeping the team more than offset the $4 million a year that the state taxpayers will pay. So I don't think it's an apples-to-apples argument.
Now, the bill goes to Governor Walker's desk for signing. What are the next steps here?
Well, I guess then they have to, you know, dot the I's and cross the T's down in Milwaukee. And I think they want to get going on it pretty soon, because I know there's a provision that they hadn't started construction by a certain date. There was a provision in the sale when Herb Cole sold the team to the current ownership that they could, you know, sell the team back to the league and get out of it if construction didn't start by a certain point. I can't remember exactly when that was, but I think it's going to be on the fast track.
We're talking right now with Don Hubscher, the editor of the Eau Claire Leader Telegram. We're getting caught up on the state's biggest stories in our Wisconsin News Roundup. And open records has been at issue here in the state for a couple of different reasons. Catch us up on the latest there.
Well, the obvious situation there was when the Republicans attempted to gut the Wisconsin open records law. And there was right before the 4th of July, and there was a rapid and vociferous opposition to that. And then there was a seminar this week that I guess had been scheduled before that, hosted by the Attorney General, where groups got together to talk about it. And this is something that comes and goes every so often, and hopefully it'll go away for a long time to come. But some public officials feel that there are certain deliberative documents and things that go on, let's just say in the informal phase of forming a bill or whatever, that they feel they shouldn't have to make public. But the problem with that is, who gets to decide when the discussion reaches the point where it should be made public? And the Wisconsin open records law is very clear that everything that they do is presumed to be open unless there's an overwhelming reason to close it. And one of the things they talked about at this seminar this week, which I did not attend, was okay, and you know, with the technology advancing the way it is, should some provisions be made for, you know, if they put body cameras on police officers and so forth, and should there, some things be rewritten? But I think the concern by the media is that once you open it up and start writing, then you're opening yourself to all kinds of mischief. And so, you know, I think it's pretty clear that, that you know, we keep it simple as it can be, that everything is assumed to be open. And when you have conversations or some kind of exchange with an elected official, you may have to assume that if it's an email, that it could be made public. And a wise man once told me that, you know, don't send an email that you don't care that the rest of the world sees.
And we did an interview this week with Attorney General Brad Schimmel about this topic, and check it out. It's available online if you want to hear more about that topic. And quickly, we want to wrap up and talk a little bit about Supreme Court Chief Justice David Prosser being part of the John Doe ruling earlier this month, and some news there about his decisions. What happened there?
Well, what happened was he didn't feel he should have had to recuse himself from the John Doe hearings, even though he accepted money in campaign donations from, you know, groups that benefited from his ruling. And, you know, I think the larger issue there is, and I've written about this many times, is, you know, just the whole idea of judges accepting campaign money and the fact that that's how we continue to do it here. And that, I mean, you can argue that free speech or freedom of expression, but the whole idea of judges accepting money for their campaigns just invites stuff like this. And I don't care what side you're on, you know, inevitably just about every decision they make can get back to somebody who has tried to influence the process.
And we leave it there. Don, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
That was Don Hubscher, editor of the Eau Claire Leader Telegram, helping us preview the biggest stories from around the state this week in our Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
We continue our new summer music series called Setlist.
We invited Wisconsin artists into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances. They'll air every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend.
Okay, we're going to talk about drummers who are also lead singers. You've got Phil Collins from Genesis, you've got Don Henley of the Eagles, and, you know, even Ringo sang a little bit. But it's not an easy thing to pull off, so it's a pretty short list.
Nicole Ray is the drummer and lead singer for the Oshkosh rock band The Traveling Suitcase. She, along with guitarist Bill Grassley, recently stopped by the WPR studios to play some songs from their latest album, Nobody Wins, and talk about how they fit into the Fox Valley music scene.
I begged my parents for a drum set for about maybe a little over 2 years. Growing up, my best friend's older brother played drums, and I just kind of would steal his broken drumsticks and bring them home and beat on pillows to records.
At the window, end of the line, mountains peaking and the sun is crying.
So let's start. Nicole, how did you guys meet? How did you get started with the band?
Well, Bill kind of jumped in mid-Suitcase. I've known the bass player and keyboard player, Brandon, for about 14 years. We started playing music after meeting in high school jazz band.
High school jazz band?
Yep.
Was that in Oshkosh?
Yep, that was in Oshkosh West.
And what did you play back in jazz band?
I played drums and percussion.
And we're not hearing your drumming here today. On the album, you mainly play drums and, of course, sing.
Yep, drums and sing. I play guitar a lot as well.
And you started, as I understand it, as the guitarist for the Traveling Suitcase.
Yep. Yeah, I did.
And made the switch to drums. How is it? I'm always curious how hard it is to sing and play drums at the same time. It looks challenging to me.
It's actually super easy. It was really difficult when I first started because I was used to the songs being in a completely different format, you know, using my brain in a different way. And now it's, you know, like when we're in a recording situation, I have to like have drumsticks in my hand.
I thought I saw you like hitting a kick pedal every now and then, starting to maybe reach out for the drumsticks while you were playing there.
Yep.
And now, Bill, you joined midway through. What was it like mixing into the existing band?
Yeah, it was interesting. There's a lot more people too. I think was seven. Was I number seven
then
at that time?
So wow, now it's a three piece. Yeah.
So I wasn't doing guitar at first, just playing horns and mandolin and keyboard every now and then. And then as things progressed and we kind of shifted around, I found my way to guitar, which I consider my main instrument.
Everybody right now is on the instruments that they're best at.
You've settled into what you really should be playing.
Truly are. I guess like not like best at, because everyone's really good at a bunch of different instruments, but I feel like all of, you know, the three of us, what we play in the band, it's our thing, you know?
Bill, this is kind of a nice rock and sound, which I like a lot. Riff heavy in a lot of places. What's the process? Is it lyrics and then you get the riff to go along with it, or hey, this sounds good, now let's match lyrics to it?
It's kind of split three ways, honestly, because like she mentioned, we all do play guitar. So sometimes if Nicole writes a song on guitar, she has the lyrics done, and then we just kind of do it that way, and then she plays drums to it. Other times, Brandon and I collaborate on guitar. And then we just kind of show up at practice, and then it all just sort of happens in the moment. And that's most of it, is we sit down and figure it all out. It's not too much premeditated.
There are four different types of songwriting within the group. There's each of us solely bringing one, and then we piece it together. And then when we write songs together, that's like the fourth piece, like when we're actually sitting down and then randomly something happens. And for me personally, I think the biggest challenge is like sitting behind the kit and writing.
Yeah, how does that work? Because you can't hit an A chord on the snare drum.
No, you can't, but you can build a, you know, we used percussion back in the day to communicate. I mean, when we didn't really know how to form words, that's how we communicated with other tribes, with other things like that. So I guess I look at it as like my birthright to communicate. So I really enjoy writing from behind the kit because it can tell a story through rhythm.
Wow.
Now listen to Nobody Wins, the new album. I'm not hearing a lot of overdubs, a lot of studio trickery. It sounds like kind of like what it would sound live.
We kept it meat and potatoes for sure.
Was that a conscious decision or just
kind
of how it happened?
I mean, and we did do overdubs. There's some like vocal harmonies, and there's definitely some thickening of guitars in some places just to build thickness, and you want to have depth for sure. Because we've pressed vinyl too, and there's definitely a really good amount of atmosphere in the way that we mixed it for listening pleasure on vinyl. But this was a Kickstarter funded album, and I feel like a lot of our fans that had come seen us live, you know, had heard those songs for, you know, like a year. So I was like, well, we better make sure that this is, you know, a really good representation of what they want as well. But I mean, personally, I like a little bit more of a raw sound anyways, because I get really disappointed when I see a good band and buy their record and I'm like, ah, sounds like polished.
Produced the life out
of
it.
Yeah, it's like, what is this?
Well, you mentioned Kickstarter. Let's talk about that. I mean, this is something that wasn't there for bands or authors or whoever,
yeah,
all the people using Kickstarter. Does it, you mentioned wanting to serve the fans who helped to fund it. Mm-hmm. I mean, does it, I could see that going two ways. Like, they're a part of it. They have some ownership.
Oh, yeah,
and you want to reward them for that.
Yeah, it's their record. It's like a family.
And I wear my fancy dresses just to impress them. All the attention mixed with affection is my affliction.
Let's talk about where you play. I mean, you're based in Oshkosh. Tell us a little bit about the scene there. I've been up to the Reptile Palace before, but that's the only club I know up there. Tell us about the Fox Valley scene.
That pretty much is. I mean, as far as like an actual music venue, I think Reptile Palace is about it.
Beckett's is really cool,
Beckett's has done a really good service to the music
scene. That's a restaurant. They have live music there, but it's like right on the river.
But yeah, I mean, it's kind of shocking how many bands did actually come out of Oshkosh, considering you mostly have to leave Oshkosh to keep playing. And so there's Dead Horses out of Oshkosh too. Ron Sage is in Madison now, and they came out of Fox Valley. Midwestern Charm is now in Milwaukee, and so it's nuts. There's a lot of really great bands up there, but for the most part, we don't play as much in Oshkosh just because we don't have the opportunities.
Now, it used to be, I think, music journalists would try to pin sort of a sound on a particular city, a Seattle sound or whatever. Yeah. Is there anything at all like that?
Every single band has a completely different genre that comes out of there. I feel like Midwestern bands, there's definitely a little bit of like bittersweet, dark and light contrast because we deal with winter. You have to be able to live through, 50 below weather.
You mentioned a vinyl. You press into vinyl. One of your songs on the new album has vinyl in the title. I can't remember the title.
Vinyl Ain't Dead?
Yeah, so Vinyl Ain't Dead, and you're helping keep it alive. I'll be honest, I don't even have a turntable. Why are you still pressing vinyl?
Looking at you, not to judge a book by a cover, but I was like, man, I bet you this guy's got a really discreet
vinyl. I kept my
vinyl
for
collection.
Years without a turntable, and I finally was like, okay, I'm not buying a turntable anytime soon. So make the case. Why should I get a turntable?
I don't know, man. There's so much more atmosphere, and I hate to sound cliche and be like one of those little vinyl nerds, but I am a vinyl nerd. It's like looking at a painting that someone actually painted and being able to feel the textures and how their brush moved and the grooves of everything like that, as opposed to someone being like, here's the laminated copy of this painting I made.
So you can, and so one could get a copy of Nobody Wins on vinyl if
yes,
they wanted to.
That is a thing.
And are you able to like still hook up with enough record stores around the state? You're in the local music
section?
Yeah,
a decent amount. Actually, we're getting rid of too much music. Like we're selling.
You can't keep up?
Yeah, we can't keep up, which is cool.
That's a great place to be.
Yep. Mama's in the kitchen cooking up some food. Well, Papa's in the basement watching all the fools.
What does success feel like for the traveling suitcase? What's the next dream?
I think for me personally, I just want to see us on the road less but more, like having just a more consistent tour schedule.
Less working three other jobs kind of thing.
And yeah, I think all of us
that's
are
what,
getting
I mean,
really
what
burnt
we
out.
Do, so we like writing. I like making records.
Awesome or horror stories from the road?
When we were in Nashville, a guitar player who used to be in our band, he decided that he was going to bring his fishing pole on tour with us. And it had a three-prong hook at the end of it. And I think it was a sudden stop. And like everyone was kind of like, woo! And then all of a sudden I was like, ah! And I was like, it hurts! I thought I sat on a bee or something because it just was stinging. And then I like got up. And our friend started laughing, and I was like, what's going on? And she's like, there's a fishing hook in your butt. So then she pulled it out.
I hope some actual fishing was done on this tour
fishing was done. That's why I was like, why did you bring this fishing pole on tour?
Is there something that you think is going to change in your approach or what you're trying to do between Nobody Wins and Untitled Next Project?
I don't think we think about that kind of stuff, man. That's a waste of stress, almost.
So,
like
whatever you come up with.
Yeah. We don't put any pressure or expectations on what we're doing other than just, being true to ourselves as musicians. And that is an open door.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming down and playing today.
Thank you very much for having us.
That was awesome.
Oshkosh band, The Traveling Suitcase. You can catch them live on August 7th at the Mile of Music Festival in Appleton.
Setlist Summer Music Series airs on Central Time Fridays at 4:15 through early September. For more about the artists featured on Setlist, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to WPR.org/setlist. That's WPR.org/setlist. Next Friday on Setlist, we'll feature the Milwaukee rock band Sat Night Duets.
This has been a lot of fun, this series. There's a lot of great music to be had. I've got to go back. I mean, I saw them play in our studio in many cases, but I've got to go back and listen to more of their music. A lot of great stuff out there in Wisconsin.
Right. If you're looking for your next favorite band or you want to get out there and see what Wisconsin has to offer, check it out. You can go back and look at on WPR.org/setlist.
Coming up, after a week of outrage over the killing of a well-known Zimbabwe lion named Cecil, we'll hear what you think about trophy hunting, legal and illegal. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
There's been an angry response this week after the release of the name of the man who killed Cecil, a well-known lion from Zimbabwe. The man, Walter Palmer, is a dentist from Minnesota. The uproar this week has led to protests at his dental practice.
In a Wisconsin connection, court documents have shown that Palmer pleaded guilty to illegally killing a black bear in Wisconsin in 2006, for which he paid a fine and was put on probation. In this case, Cecil the lion was reportedly lured off of a wildlife reserve by professional Zimbabwe hunters and shot by Palmer on private land. Palmer said he didn't know that the lion was lured off of a reserve. He reportedly paid the hunters $50,000 to lead him on that hunt.
In addition to protesting this particular incident, many people have called for an end to trophy hunting in general. While this killing appears to have been illegal, some conservationists argue the outrage shouldn't lead to broader restrictions on trophy hunting because it could actually be beneficial to conservation overall. Nikki Rust joins us now. She's a PhD candidate in biodiversity management at the University of Kent. She co-wrote a piece for The Conversation called Why Killing Lions Like Cecil May Actually Be Good for Conservation. She joins us now. Nikki, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
Now, before we get to legal trophy hunting in general, you do point out in your piece that illegal trophy hunting, as in this particular case, is not good for conservation. What kind of damage can be done by things like poaching and unregulated hunting?
Well, poaching is a very different matter to trophy hunting, and the main problem with poaching is that because it's illegal, we're not exactly sure the amount of lions that are being killed. People obviously try to be very, very secretive about these kinds of things, and so you can't really monitor it, which means you can't really control it. So we need to be very clear about how we're talking about hunting. There's the legal killing and the illegal killing. Obviously, illegal killing is extremely bad, so don't condone that absolutely at all.
Now, let's turn to legal trophy hunting. There's been, as we mentioned, there have been calls for bans on trophy hunting of lions and other species over this last week as people are protesting. What is your response to that? What do you see? What would we lose if we didn't have legal trophy hunting?
A very good question. Well, actually, there's a big consensus among big cat conservationists in the world who almost all believe that trophy hunting, if it's done successfully, can benefit big cats. It sounds counterintuitive, I know, but hear me out on this. So if we banned trophy hunting, then we would probably lose about 60,000 square kilometers, I'm not quite sure what that is in miles, I'm sorry, of habitat. And this is probably going to go to mining and agriculture. Trophy hunting brings in a lot of revenue. Obviously, a lot of this argument about trophy hunting has been about money. So if you put value on a lion, people are going to want to protect it. In Namibia, where I did most of my research, which is in southern Africa, it's now illegal to import trophies of cheetahs into the U.S., and from doing my research in Namibia, I found from the farmers who live with cheetahs, they see them as vermin now. They see them that they have absolute no value, and so they're just killing all of them. So this has been shown in many different situations where there's been temporary bans on trophy hunting, like in Zambia between 2000 and 2003, the wildlife declined. When trophy hunting was banned in Kenya in the 1970s, wildlife declined. So I know it sounds very strange that if we have this sort of situation where we're killing animals, how can it be good for conservation? But if you're putting value on these things, people feel that they need to protect them more than if you just say, no, we can't kill anything at all.
So this is an economic incentive for the local people, or at least some segment of a local population, to say, hey, it's worthwhile to keep land as habitat instead of, as you say, a farm or a mine. It's worth making sure these animals survive instead of killing them to protect a farm. So there, because it has this economic value, the locals are on board with conservation.
Definitely. And it depends on which country we're talking about trophy hunting. Each different country has different regulations as to how the money gets transferred. Again, I talk about Namibia because that's what I know best. There, they have a situation where local communities are able to collectively manage their land in what's called a conservancy. And this tends to be on communal land, land which is owned by Black Namibians, very, very poor people who have been previously disadvantaged. When they are allowed to create a conservancy, it basically becomes a protected area. But they're not only doing sort of photographic tourism, they're allowed to do trophy hunting. And in 2013, $5 million US dollars was created out of these conservancies. Of that, $1.5 million US dollars was from trophy hunting. And not only that, not only the money, they also benefited from 500,000 kilograms of meat that year as well. So they're getting a lot of benefits from trophy hunting. And about a third of these conservancies, their main income is trophy hunting. So if we banned trophy hunting, there's about 175,000 people that are in these conservancies in Namibia. We would basically be making these poor people much, much poorer.
Talking to biodiversity researcher Nikki Rust from the University of Kent about the shooting of Cecil the Lion and the debate over trophy hunting that's been breaking out with protests over this last week. Now, I've seen an argument, Nikki, that says, hey, let's make this a tourist thing. People can come see the lions or whatever animal in question, take pictures, spend their money, pay to do that. That'll bring in the revenue. They don't actually need to shoot them. Does it add up, do you think?
In certain situations, it does. So it seems that in India, for example, where they don't have trophy hunting, it's working very well, this photographic tourism. And the recent census of tigers showed that, surprisingly, tigers are increasing, which is wonderful. So it's working well there. We don't need to have trophy hunting there. Great. I don't really like trophy hunting. I think it's not nice to kill animals in any circumstance. So I'm not really for it, but I see that the statistics show me that, you know, in certain situations, if it's done well, then it increases the population. So I think it's very easy to judge this industry and to see these horrific pictures of people posing with these dead animals and to make sort of assumptions about these people. But, I mean, I'm a vegan. I don't like anyone killing any animals at all. I'm a big cat lover. I think I'm probably one of the biggest animal geeks that I know. I love nature. So coming from me, someone who loves big cats, to actually say, hang on a minute, I've been studying this topic for 5 years now, and I can see that this really does have a benefit if it's done well in some of these countries. Tourism, photographic tourism, does have problems. It's only suitable in certain areas because people who go on these photographic safaris, they want beautiful scenery. They don't really want to have sort of people in the way. They don't want livestock getting in their pictures, whereas hunters don't really mind that. So this opens up lots more areas for conservation. Also, tourists, photographic tourists, don't really like going to unsafe areas or sort of politically unstable areas where it's been shown that hunters don't mind. And also we've got to think about the ecological impact of photographic tourism. It's a mass industry. We're getting millions of people coming to Africa each year. Now, if you just think about the carbon footprint of all of these tourists traveling internationally, yes, they're not killing any animals, but let's just think about this holistically. How much damage are they doing to the world with all of this international airfare when we have trophy hunting, which, if you compare one trophy hunter to one photographic tourist, trophy hunters bring in much more money per person, and the ecological footprint, particularly in terms of the carbon miles, is much less.
Nikki, you use the phrase trophy hunting when done well. What kind of rules in places like Zimbabwe or Namibia, what kind of rules need to be in place to make sure this has the best impact on conservation, the least negative impact on the area?
There are many different things that we can improve, particularly in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe, of course, everyone knows, has been quite politically unstable, and it suffers from corruption. It's very difficult to sort out corruption, but we can try to improve the regulations. So currently, when it comes to lion trophy hunting, there are age limits. You can only shoot a male lion. You're not allowed to shoot female lions. You can only shoot a male lion that's over 6 years old. But we need to make sure that this is definitely happening, because it seems from the research that sometimes people take younger males, and that can really affect the population. So we must make sure that it's the old males who have already contributed to the gene pool. Now, because lions are social creatures, another argument against trophy hunting of lions is that if you take out the male, then a new male will come into the pride and will kill all the cubs. And this, of course, happens. So we also need to make sure that the quotas for lion trophy hunting take this into consideration, and they have to be very, very low. We need to make sure that if this happens and if cubs are killed, then it's not going to negatively affect the population. So maybe something that we can do is increase the price of trophy hunting and dramatically reduce the quotas. And then one other thing that I think is a potential solution, something that's happened in forestry and in food, is certification. So maybe having some kind of labeling or certification that we can prove that this is sort of ethical, if you would like to call it that, trophy hunting, or something that has been rated by an external body, audited, to make sure that they are doing what they're saying that they're doing.
We're talking to Nikki Rust. She's with the University of Kent, talking about the debate over trophy hunting after a week of outrage over the killing of Cecil the lion.
Yeah, we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think trophy hunting should be illegal? Do you think it's justified by economic benefits like revenue for poor countries that could be spent on other kinds of conservation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about trophy hunting in light of the killing of Cecil the lion. The name of the Minnesota dentist who killed the lion was released this week, and there's been a global outcry. We're talking to Nikki Rust, PhD candidate in biodiversity management at the University of Kent.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your response to this particular incident, the killing of Cecil the lion in Zimbabwe? Do you think, is this an isolated case? Is it more representative of trophy hunting as a whole? And should trophy hunting be illegal, as some protesters are saying, or do you see value for conservation, as our guest says? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jeremiah starts us off in La Crosse. Jeremiah, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I'm a hunter myself. I'm not necessarily an African trophy game hunter, but I follow hunting pretty religiously, so to speak, and I think what we're dealing with here is kind of an isolated incident. I don't know how much blame can be put on the Minnesota dentist as far as to what he knew as to the region he was hunting, you know, if he knew that they were drawing this lion out of this reserve. But if you look at the facts of trophy hunting, especially in the African area like that, the money that gets brought in for this, most of it, if not all of it, if I'm not mistaken, and from the studies and the people that I've talked to in the industry, you know, that money goes directly towards the conservation efforts for a lot of those animals to help prevent illegal poaching, and to help with other aspects. for those reserves. And, you know, the meat and the carcass for a lot of animals taken, whether it be lions or elephants or, you know, what other animals are out there, typically all go back to the local tribes.
Jeremiah, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring Nikki in on this. He was backing up some of what you said, Nikki. There have been accusations that, hey, not as much of the money as they claim goes directly into conservation. What can be done, Nikki, to make sure that the money going into these trophy hunts is a lot of it being used for conservation?
Yeah, I mean, that is true. In Zimbabwe, not very much goes towards the local communities, and that is a real, real shame, particularly as in the past they used to have a community-based conservation scheme called Campfire, which was much more equitable, where they did provide much more of the income towards the communities. I think this is a political issue. It would be great if they could change the laws so that more could be given to the local communities. However, I will state that 25% of the income from trophy hunting in Zimbabwe does go to the government, and obviously that is going to go back into building schools and hospitals and roads and things, and so it does still benefit the community. However, they're not seeing direct direct benefits, so it would be wonderful if they could get some better benefits from that. And I think we can all learn a lot from, sorry to keep banging on about this, but Namibia is a perfect example as how you can do trophy hunting well, and it's going to be beneficial for people and wildlife. Since it was implemented in 1996, there has been exponential growth in trophy hunted species. So, for example, in 1995, elephants in Namibia, there was only 2,500, whereas in 2013, there was 20,000 of them. And these are species that are actually trophy hunted in Namibia.
Nikki, so, I want to bring in another caller. We go next to PJ in Milwaukee. PJ, hi.
Hello.
What do you think, PJ?
I just think it should be illegal.
Now, why is that?
Because no one should have the right to take the life of another powerful being just because you have a powerful weapon.
PJ, thanks for the call. And that's, you said, Nikki, you're a vegan, you don't like the killing of animals. That's also an argument that I imagine resonates with you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like it. I would never go trophy hunting myself. What I do find fascinating is that this is an argument that I've heard a lot, and yet many of these people don't seem to mind killing animals to eat. You know, we don't need to eat meat to survive, so we're actually only doing it for pleasure. So I don't quite see the difference in killing an animal for sport and then to put on your above your fireplace to killing an animal to then eat it, just having a few moments on your tongue. So, yeah, an interesting argument.
PJ, thanks a lot for the call. So as we look ahead, I mean, this thing about Cess the Lion probably isn't going to die down anytime soon. Do you think that we're going to see changes in legal trophy hunting as a result of this outcry?
I think that hopefully the best case scenario for me would be, and I think for Africa as a whole, its people and its wildlife, would be to ensure the regulations are made much more strict. I don't think that it's going to be banned. I think that maybe some countries that are seeing population declines are maybe going to have a look at their quotas and reduce them, or maybe put temporary bans on them. But I think the history has told us that trophy hunting is just so beneficial for wildlife that we really can't afford to ban it.
And are you worried that this whole argument over trophy hunting might distract from other important issues of conservation totally unrelated to hunting?
Potentially, yes. But I think that the money that has been coming in just related to this whole Cecil incident, I know that Oxford University, who were the people who were monitoring Cecil, just in the last week, because of this whole issue, they have received donations equivalent to, I think, $500,000. So this money that has been raised from this incident is going to go for many different types of programs involved in big cat conservation. So, yes, the media have just been focusing on this, but the people who are actually working on the ground, who are being able to get money from conservation and from trophy hunting, we're still working out how we can try and reduce this biodiversity loss.
Nikki, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem.
That was Nikki Rust with the University of Kent talking about trophy hunting as protests continue over the shooting of Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe. You can continue the conversation, share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
Surveys indicate that most people want to die at home, but it's estimated only 25% of Americans actually end up doing that. Instead, they live their last days in a hospital, a nursing home, or a long-term care facility. Shemaine Mills looks at efforts to get people to advocate for the care that they want and where they want it by writing it down.
Michael Bernhagen was so moved by his mother's death, he made a documentary about a subject few want to talk about. His own unease with death reflects that of the general population.
I'd never been in the presence of a dying person before, so I had no idea what to do. And thankfully, my intuition told me that I should sit down by my mom's hospital bed and hold her hands, which I did. I held her hands.
His mother had advanced vascular dementia, and Bernhagen wasn't even sure she recognized him.
But something about the look in her eyes was telling my heart otherwise, and she started kissing my hands and stroking my face, and all of a sudden released my hands and made a gesture, you know, as if she said, "Why don't you come in? I got something to say to you." Lean in a little bit closer. And staring me deeply in the eyes, she uttered four simple words that I didn't know it at the time, but would later change the course of my life, and those four simple words were, "I've always loved you."
Bernhagen says she'd never told him that. The experience taught him what matters most to people at the end of life has little to do with medicine and a lot to do with relationships. Medical technology can prolong life in cases that wouldn't have been possible in the past. Attorney Ben Adams reminds people of this when he talks to groups about advanced care planning.
This is the last 35 years when medical technology made those leaps to where they can keep us from dying or bring us back from the dead, but they can't restore our health.
Adams is involved in promoting Honoring Choices, a Wisconsin Medical Society initiative to discuss future medical decisions. John Maycroft directs Honoring Choices for the society.
Really, it's about values and what really is important to that person. So for me, for example, I have a 3.5-year-old son. And if I can watch him smear yogurt on his face for 30 minutes every morning, I hardly care what the rest of my day looks like. I don't want to be in screaming pain. I want to be able to communicate. But for me, the priority is to watch my son grow up. And if I have to go through medical misery and back to get there, that's worth it to me.
These initial conversations are designed to get people to think who their healthcare agent should be or whether they want to write down their wishes. Honoring Choices Wisconsin started in 2012 with 6 health systems. Maycroft says it now has 25 organizations on board.
The progress has been extraordinary. It's been more successful than we ever imagined. It's also been a lot harder and slower than we ever imagined.
The Medical Society got behind this effort after seeing Consider the Conversation, a series of documentaries about end-of-life issues by Bernhagen and Terry Koldestal.
We at the Society didn't know what we were going to do. We didn't know how to do it, but it was clearly something that where something needed to be done.
It makes sense the medical community would get on board since medical facilities are where more and more Americans are dying.
If there's one thing that Terry Koldestal and I have learned from producing the Consider the Conversation films over the last 6 years, is it's that our success at fighting disease and extending life has created a new problem.
Bernhagen says that success has fundamentally changed how and where Americans die. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Remember, you can join in conversations over at the Central Time Facebook page and check out Setlist, the ongoing summer music series. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.